Okay, so I was almost a blurred, right? A black nerd. And like any almost blurred, I wanted to do nerd things, like magic tricks. I practiced and I practiced and I practiced and I got to the point I could make just about anything smaller than a 50-cent piece vanish. But that's not all. I could talk about black holes, Gandalf, time machines, and all the atomic level 15th degree nerds. They hung out together. I'd see them painting their Gollum figurines, memorizing pi, trading Psi Neuromancer books, and it looked like so much fun. But then they'd kind of nod to each other. They'd leave the lunch table, the hallway, the sidewalk, and they'd just disappear. Well, to the untrained eye, they'd disappear, but I knew better. All you had to do was follow the clank of the 20-sided dice, track it all the way back to a forgotten utility storage closet, where they created an oasis. A Diet Coke-fueled Shangri-La where they could play Dungeons and Dragons. I didn't know much about D&D, but I longed to join them. They had people called Dungeon Masters, and these folk created maps and charts and stuff. They'd send players on quests. You could be a wizard or a troll or an elf. But most importantly, in the game, you could do magic. I just caught bits and pieces from the other side of the closed utility closet door, but I couldn't go in. I was forbidden from going in. Not because I was black. They didn't care about that. No, because my pastor at church took the pulpit one Sabbath morning and proclaimed that in Ohio or Nebraska or some faraway place, a group of teenagers decide to play this Dungeons and Dragons on a Friday evening. One of these young men, a fellow by the name of Huey Sherman, called upon the power of a demon in the game. Well, a fiery devil erupted from the ground. But not just in the game, brethren. In the real world, Satan spawn sprung out of the rafters and dragged each and every one of these boys down to hell. And neither Huey Sherman nor his friends were ever seen from again. Now, I'll be honest, I thought the pastor's story had a few holes in it. But I didn't want to burn in everlasting torment either on some kind of spiritual technicality. So I figured the safe bet was to just go ahead and avoid Dungeons and Dragons. No dragons, no dungeons, no magic. So there I stood, stuck, my head pressed against the utility closet door, almost a blurred. And I say almost because what kind of blurred has never gone on a magical quest to slay a dragon? My body felt like it was rending itself in two. And luckily, I knew someone who felt exactly the same way. Matt was another nerd at church, but unlike me, Matt was a nerd with a plan. He told me, Glenn, if your game, my brother and I, we've created an alternative to D&D. One that morphs the cosmology to one more consistent with biblical principles. If we're circumspecting our gameplay, it should be allowed.
Does it have any dragons?
Well, this was tricky. In my first module, The Garden of Eden, it has lurking within it a Leviathan, which according to biblical stuff, does it have any dragons?
Yes, there's a dragon.
I'm in. It was awesome. Instead of magic, which is evil, we deployed the power of the Holy Spirit depending on the roll of the dice. Witches became mages. Wizards were apostles. Trolls were heathens. Matt assumed his rightful place at the head of the table as Dungeon Master. Actually, Bible Land Master. He was brilliant. His game deployed a series of traps and puzzles. We laughed at Adam's folly. Spoke to the great serpent as it tempted Eve. I even took a bite of the forbidden apple. It tasted fantastic. To a casual observer, it might appear as if we were discussing biblical history, except directly after church one day, I rolled 2 sevens in a row and used my Holy Spirit powers to turn all the rivers to wine. and the daughters of Eve rejoiced and begged to become my personal concubines. And I knew from Bible study that it was only right to accept their gracious offer, so I sent them back to my tent, and the pastor, who just happened to be standing right behind me, started barking in fury.
What is this mockery?
And just like that, the jig was up. And I couldn't believe it was over. It couldn't be over. I hadn't even slain a dragon. I hadn't vanquished a city. Pastor pointed to the 20-headed dice. Give those to me. Everyone kind of sat with their heads down. I picked up the dice. They jiggled in my hand. Give me those right now. I held up my closed palm. Hand them over. I opened my hand. Empty. The dice had disappeared. Everyone gasped.
What did you do?
I told him that mysterious forces were at play. He patted me down till he felt something. I feigned a look of surprise as he pulled the dice out of my pocket.
It's a shame. It's a real shame.
And suddenly, I felt bad. Actually, I felt horrible, like I had sinned against myself. Magic. I'd practiced that trick for 6 months. And I knew better than to stick them in my front pocket. Today, on Snap Judgment, from WNYC, we proudly present Presto. Amazing stories from real people looking for a miracle. My name is Glenn Washington. Set your magic wand to stun, because this is Snap Judgment. Now, there are magic tricks, the kind your uncle performed for the kids at Thanksgiving. And then there are magic tricks, the kind where every member of the audience holds their breath because the stakes are life and death. Snap Judgment's Anna Sussman spoke to a real magician, Mr. Steve Cohen.
The moment it became real for me, where I started to have a little bit of cold feet, was when I visited the firing range. I was actually now standing on the end of the range where typically they have those paper targets. No one's supposed to stand there. Like, people don't stand there. That's just not something you do. And I had a man standing on the other end with a pretend gun in his hand. He was just holding his finger up like, you know, kids play cowboys and Indians. That's when it really became real. My palms started to sweat a little bit. And you know, at that point also, I knew that I had to do it, so I couldn't turn back. But still, I have two kids. I'm married, and I didn't want to leave, you know, my wife, a single mom. I never wanted to do the bullet catch. It was actually something I never wanted to perform.
It's known as the deadliest trick in all of magic. At one end of the stage, a gun, loaded in front of the audience. At the other end of the stage, the magician. In between the two, a pane of glass. The gun is fired directly at the magician. The glass explodes.
Some magicians were attempting to catch the bullet in their hands. Some of the magicians caught the bullet on a plate. Some of the magicians actually tried to catch the bullet on the tip of a sword. And the most deadly and probably most visceral of all these is to catch the bullet in your mouth. And, you know, these are risky ventures. The first time I ever heard of the bullet catch, it was just mind-blowing to me that someone would stand in front of a gun and have a bullet fired at their face and attempt to catch it in their mouth. And little did I know that I would be standing facing a gun myself years later and attempting that same feat. The legend of the bullet catch is that 12 magicians have died, and nobody wants to be number 13.
Some magicians were killed by faulty props, others by opportunistic assistants or wives. One magician shot and killed his own son on stage. He was jailed. Performers now like to claim that the trick is haunted.
I wanted to tell the story of the bullet catch because it's really an excellent story, particularly the true story, of Cheng Ling Su, who is a very famous illusionist from the early 20th century.
Cheng Ling Su performed the bullet catch over and over again for audiences across England. And as he did, his guns and their secret compartments wore down.
He went on stage and was attempting to perform his defying the bullets trick, as he always had. In his version, he used to catch the bullet on a porcelain plate. I've actually held the plate that he used. He was performing this, and the bullet actually pierced through his body, and he fell down onto the stage. Of course, the audience probably thought this was part of the act, but he yelled out. Now remember, he was a supposed Chinese performer who never spoke a word of English on stage. Suddenly he yelled out in English in kind of a Brooklyn accent,
"Something went wrong. Lower the curtain."
See, Cheng Ling Su wasn't really Chinese. His real name was William Robertson. But for years, he took the stage posturing as a Chinese conjurer. He never spoke on stage, but pantomimed and gestured. After the curtain was lowered that night, Cheng Ling Su nor William Robertson ever performed again.
The bullet penetrated his left lung, and he died shortly after the performance ended. And I loved the story of Cheng Ling Su, and I wanted to dramatize that. When you're a performer, when you're a magician particularly, you're always trying to figure out the next most thrilling thing to entertain your audience with. And after what I've done in my own career, I thought that this might be an excellent way to really build up interest in, for my own audiences. So I said, I'm going to do it. And once I made up my mind, then it was just basically a fait accompli. I knew that I was going to have to actually pull this off.
Up until now, Steve had performed close-up magic. Card tricks for polite audiences in velvet-lined parlors. Catching a bullet in his teeth would propel him to the level of the greats. But he had very little experience with dangerous tricks like this. So he began planning with meticulous research. He asked for advice from men who had survived the trick, like Simon Drake, who had performed the bullet catch on British TV.
When I met Simon, he told me, no matter what, don't perform this trick. He said that it really changed him. It made him more paranoid about life in general. He almost had a breakdown after performing it.
But Steve had already signed a TV contract, committing to performing the trick. He'd spent months preparing every detail with a team of directors. So he stepped onto the firing range.
The way that the illusion looked was I had a bullet removed from the clip. I walked over to a random member of the audience, and I asked someone, random guy, to take a permanent marker and to mark the bullet. Then the bullet was returned to the clip, loaded into the gun.
And Steve stood 20 feet away and stared into that loaded gun.
I extended my arms in a crucifix pose to prove that my hands are far away from my mouth and not slipping anything into my mouth. And I held a white handkerchief, which I used as my signal for him to fire. And I stood there for as long as I needed to mentally be ready for this. It is emotional. It becomes an emotional experience when you see a gun facing you. This could go wrong. Now I just have to stay calm. I let go of the white handkerchief. He pulls the trigger.
Trigger.
I felt something pierce my chest, and my whole body kind of caved in and then just dropped straight to the ground. I had no control over my body. I just slumped straight down. I truly thought to myself, I can't believe this is happening to me, because this is exactly what I tried to avoid when I was learning all about Chung Ling Su. I thought, now I'm Chung Ling Su. I'm Chung Ling Steve. Something went wrong. Lower the curtain. And I'm on the ground writhing in pain. This was not planned at all. There was mayhem. Like, people were going, what went wrong? And people were running around, EMTs being called. And the cameraman ran straight up towards me, writhing on the ground in pain. I spit the signed bullet out onto the ground next to me. It is indeed the signed bullet. At the same moment, the EMT comes running up to me, cuts open my shirt. I didn't understand what had happened.
The curse of the bullet catch. Or the peril of standing in front of a gun. Or the danger of standing in front of a pane of glass as it shatters. Because here's what happened. A flying shard of glass traveled through Steve's shirt, entering his body just above his heart. Still, he got his wish. He successfully performed the deadly bullet catch.
I wasn't trying to prove anything by performing the bullet catch. The best way I could describe it is that the bullet catch is a very important part of the annals of magic history. And I wanted to enter into those annals of history by attempting it.
Steve and a long line of magicians stretching back the 400 years the trick has been in existence have known the dangers of the bullet catch. And they attempted the trick anyway. And when the next eager magician in that line turns to Steve...
My advice to magicians who are thinking of performing the bullet catch is to avoid it. Don't do it. It's a mistake. Stick to card tricks. There are other ways to thrill an audience than to truly risk your own life.
Don't do it. Do not do it, Snappers. We want to thank Steve Cohen for sharing his story. He's got a running show in New York City at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Find out more about Steve Cohen on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Renzo Gorio. When Snap returns, we're going to make it rain. And magic is best used when it's used for revenge. For real. When Snap Judgment Storytelling with the Beat continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Presto episode. Today, we're talking to people in possession of strange and wondrous powers. And our next story is about the time that comes in every young man's life when he discovers that magic, contrary to everything he has ever been led to believe, is not cool.
When I was a kid, I did magic. And when I say a kid, I don't mean when I was 8 years old I did magic. You know, the way you did magic when you were a kid? With that plastic magic set your parents got you for Christmas with the thumb tip and the little box that broke the pencil into three pieces and then turned it back into a whole pencil? I'm talking about, I was doing birthday parties when I was a freshman in high school. Full-on 15-year-old magic dork with a fancy magic table and a kid's tuxedo jacket with secret pockets and a cane that turned into flowers and a pet dove named Priscilla. I had business cards. Mystical Acts of Magic, they said. And next to my name was Ed's name. Ed was a junior. He was my magic mentor. I met Ed at my best friend Stuart's house after Stuart's big brother saw me doing some coin tricks for the other kids. You should meet Ed. He's a real magician. The suggestion that somehow I wasn't a real magician offended me, but Stuart assured me that his brother wasn't messing around. Ed's no joke, man.
He made an orange appear in this box right in front of me. I mean, it just appeared. I have no clue how he did it.
I knew how he did it. Stuart was describing a trick called the crystal casket. A simple, clear plastic box, about 6 inches tall. Yet objects seemed to just materialize inside the clear box right before your eyes. The secret was simple. One of the sides of the box was a mirror. The object was hidden behind it. The mirror was spring-loaded and could drop so fast you wouldn't even notice it. All you noticed was the load or the object appearing inside the box. Stuart was right. Ed was no joke. Crystal casket must have cost $60. Who was this older magician with $60? I had to meet him. Ed and I hit it off right away. He was frenetic, talkative, nervous, weird. He was always trying to be funny, to make people laugh, either with him or at him. It didn't matter which. He lived to entertain others. Ed never left home without a huge leather bag filled with tricks. He was always prepared for a magic show at any given moment, and wherever Ed went, people were happy to see him. Do a trick, Ed! Hey, Ed Magic, show us a trick! Ed loved the attention, and I loved watching him perform. Ed was happy to take me under his wing. He told me he'd tried to teach other kids magic in the past, but none of them were very serious about it. None of them had the discipline required to get good at magic. They merely wanted to learn the secrets. I was different, he said. I had what it took. I told my parents my new plan was to become a professional magician. My father rolled his eyes. My mom said, "Well, you better start making some money then." She introduced me to Bobby, the leader of a local biker gang. He was also a pimp. Some of the girls he'd hire out for parties and whatnot, just to dance, nothing hardcore. She had heard he was in the market to just go legit, you know, get some clowns and jugglers and whatnot. "My boy and his weird friend can do magic," she told him. "Can they drive?" "Yeah, the weird one can." "Tell him to call me. I got a job for him." And just like that, Ed and I went to work for Bobby the Pimp. He got us some birthday party gigs, and eventually he scored us a job doing magic at the local Pizza Hut every Tuesday night for kids' night. The manager would pay us each $25 and gave us free pizza at the end of the night to take home. I don't know what Bobby the Pimp's cut was, but I'm sure it was a lot more. It wasn't glamorous, but it was a chance to try out new tricks and routines and patter on a new audience every week. Sometimes we'd even bring some stuff that was pretty fancy for a bunch of kids at Pizza Hut. We'd set things on fire. We'd produce and vanish a dove. Once Ed even brought the crystal casket. "Here, examine the box. Make sure there's no trap doors or anything," Ed instructed some kid. The kid stuck his hand in the box so hard, he cracked the mirror. And he ruined Ed's crystal casket. Ed shrugged it off and moved on to the next trick. I was devastated for him. A few months later, Bobby went to prison on a kidnapping charge, and soon after that, in what I'm sure was a complete coincidence, the manager at Pizza Hut decided that she did not like magic. At least, not for $50 a week. At the end of our show, she's paying us our money, and she said, "I'll tell y'all what. I'll let y'all keep doing your little magic show, but I'm not paying you any more money. I'm just paying in pizza from now on." "How much pizza?" I asked. "No way, Dave," Ed admonished me. "We don't work for pizza." "Well, y'all can do next week since it's the Christmas party, but after that, we're done." On the way home, Ed was dejected. "I didn't really think you liked that job anyway," I said. "I didn't, but I needed the money. It's Christmas." That weekend, my dad drove me to Little Rock. He'd asked me what I wanted for Christmas that year, and I told him I wanted something from Colonel Seymour's. Colonel Seymour's was the only magic shop in all of Central Arkansas. And more than a magic shop, it was just a huge mess of magic props and effects piled up in the garage of a man who was probably mentally ill who called himself Colonel Seymour. His house was decorated with mannequins and yard animals and hand-painted signs. He greeted us that Saturday morning during a rare Arkansas snowfall, wearing nothing but a bathrobe and slippers. He offered my dad his hand and introduced himself as the Colonel. My dad, a Vietnam veteran infantryman who suffered no fools gladly, grimaced. But then he looked at the panicked look on my face and begrudgingly took the colonel's hand and shook it. The colonel took us to the garage to look for the trick we had come for. my Christmas gift from my dad, the crystal casket. That next Tuesday, Ed picked me up to take me to our final Pizza Hut show. I gave him the crystal casket. Merry Christmas, Ed. He was shocked.
I didn't get you anything.
Well, that's okay. We'll use it in our act. It's like it's for both of us. Yeah, Ed was relieved. Cool. The scene at Pizza Hut that night was a horror show. The place wasn't filled with the usual 7 and 8 year old crumb snatchers. No, there was an entire boys' peewee football team awards banquet happening at the same time as the kids' night Christmas party. And all the 12 and 13 year old boys wanted to watch the magic show. 12 and 13 year old boys. The worst kind of boy there is. Gangly and hairy and stinky. Worst of all, these boys weren't really all that much younger than I was. The worst thing about doing magic for a 13-year-old boy is that he doesn't like to be fooled. He only wants one thing, for you to screw up. Ed and I's act was basically a handoff between the two of us. He'd do a routine, a few tricks in a row with some patter, then I did a routine, and then he'd come out and do a big routine to finish off the show. I wasn't half the magician Ed was, and my portion of the show mostly consisted of easier effects, less impressive stuff, self-contained tricks that fooled most little kids, but really had no effect at all on older kids or adults. Where Ed would deliver his lines like a professional stage comic, I stammered through my act every week as if it was just my first time ever speaking in public. Ed was more than just a talented magician. He was a showman. He had no fear on stage, and he commanded respect. I had none of that. And on this night, our final night, I did not find my voice. I bombed hard. I was doing a trick called the zombie, where a silver ball floats mysteriously underneath a silk scarf. One of the boys ran up on stage and he yanked the scarf from my hands, exposing the rod that connected the floating ball to my thumb. Everyone roared with laughter. You suck, one yelled. Nice zit, another said. I looked up at Ed with fear in my face. Ed was mad. It was one thing that they were teasing me, but I should be able to handle that if I'm going to make it in showbiz, I'm sure he thought. But an audience member coming on stage uninvited, snatching away a prop? This was a mortal transgression. Ed Magic did not get down like that. Ed came to the front of the stage and he said, "Okay, who wants to come up here and help me with a trick?" Every boy shot his hand up. Ed brought one kid up on stage, a big, jockish one with a mullet and expensive pair of Gerber jeans. He handed the boy a spongy red ball. "Here, close this up tightly in your fist," he instructed, "and hold your arms out like this." Ed held both the boy's fists out to each side. "Now, would you be amazed if when I counted to three, that ball jumped out of this hand and into this one?" "Yeah, that'd be amazing," the kid puffed. "One, two, three," Ed told the kid to open his hands. The ball was still in its original hand. Nothing had happened. The kids cracked up. Ed scratched his head. I screwed up. "Here, let me try someone else." So Ed brought another boy up from the football team. Again, he gave the kid the ball, held out his fist to either side, counted to three, and poof, nothing. The ball stayed in the same hand. Ed looked genuinely perplexed. He did it a third time with a third boy. One, two, three, nothing. By now, even the gross coaches were laughing and slapping each other high fives in celebration of Ed's failure. I couldn't understand it. What was he doing? What even was this trick? I shot Ed a look. He looked back at me and just shrugged his shoulders. Eventually, Ed tried the trick on every boy on the team, failing each and every time, each time getting a bigger and bigger reaction from the crowd. Expecting a big payoff at the end, they all hushed and quieted down. But Ed just said, "Well, I guess I need more practice. Sorry. Merry Christmas, everybody." And with that, he packed up our stuff and he headed for the door. Julie said, "What was that?" "Don't worry about it," Ed said abruptly.
Well, what kind of pizza do y'all want?
Keep the pizza. And out the door we went.
We spent the first few minutes of the drive home sitting in stunned silence, Ed driving faster than he normally does. I eventually broke the silence. What happened back there?
I figured out what to get you for Christmas, Ed smiled.
Yeah?
What?
He rolled down the car window. The cold winter air filled the car as Ed sped down Central Avenue. He rolled his shirt sleeve up on his left arm. From his wrist to his elbow were maybe 8 or 9 kids' watches. He took the first one off, a digital one with a bright red band, and he handed it to me. Merry Christmas, Dave. He took the second one off and he flung it out the window. Then the next one, and the next one. And we laughed and laughed as he flung those watches out the window into the cold winter night.
That story was told by David Hill, with help from Cameron Fleming. David is a contributor to Grantland and a writer at the Upright Citizens Brigade. His work can be seen on davidhillonline.com. And many thanks to John Solomon's 25-hour holiday radio show on WPRB, which is where we found this story. For more stories from John's show, visit keepingscoreathome.com. Now, when Snap Judgment returns, how to win friends and influence enemies magically. Stay tuned. From WNYC, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Presto episode. Today, we're calling on mysterious forces and we're going to strap on the Snap Judgment time machine. Our own Eliza Smith takes the controls and spins the dial back 100 years into the past.
California, 1904. In the fields, oranges dry in their rinds. In the burbs, lawns yellow. Poppies wilt on the hillsides. Meanwhile, Charles Hadfield sits at a desk in his father's Los Angeles sewing machine business. His dad wants him to take over someday, but Charlie doesn't want to spend the rest of his life knocking on doors and convincing housewives to buy his bobbins and thread. Charlie doesn't look like the kind of guy who changes the world. He's impossibly thin, with a vanishing patch of mousy hair. He always wears the same drab tweed suit. But he thinks to himself, just maybe he can quench the Southland's thirst. So when he punches out his time card, he doesn't go home for dinner. Instead, he sneaks off to the Los Angeles Public Library and pores over stacks of books. He reads about shamans who believe that fumes from a pyre of herbs and alcohols could force rain from the sky. He reads modern texts, too, about the pseudoscience of pluviculture, rainmaking. The theory that explosives and pyrotechnics could crack the clouds. Charlie conducts his first weather experiment on his family ranch, just northeast of Los Angeles in the city of Pasadena. One night, he pulls his youngest brother, Paul, out of bed to keep watch with a shotgun as he climbs atop a windmill, pours a cocktail of chemicals into a shallow pan, and then waits. He doesn't have a burner, or a fan, or some hybrid. No, he just waits for the chemicals to evaporate into the clouds. Paul slumped into a slumber long ago and is now leaning against the foundation of the windmill when the first droplet hits Charlie's cheek. Then another. And another. Charlie pulls out his rain gauge and measures 0.65 inches. It's enough to convince him he can make rain. That's right. Charlie has the power. Word spreads in local papers, and one by one, small towns, Hemet, Volta, Gastein, Newman, Crow's Landing, Patterson, come to him, begging for rain. And wherever Charlie goes, rain seems to follow. After he gives their town 7 more inches of water than his contract stipulated, the Hemet News raves, Mr. Hatfield is proving beyond doubt that rain can be produced. Within weeks, he's signing contracts with towns from the Pacific Coast to the Mississippi. Of course, there are doubters who claim that he tracks the weather, who claim he's a fool chasing his luck. But then, Charlie gets an invitation to prove himself. San Diego, a major city, is starting to talk water rations, and they call on him. Of course, most of the city councilmen are dubious of Charlie's charlatan claims, but still, cows are keeling over in their pastures, and farmers are worrying over dying crops. It won't hurt to hire him. They reason, if Charlie Hatfield can fill San Diego's biggest reservoir, Morena Dam, with 10 billion gallons of water, he'll earn himself $10,000. If he can't, well, then he'll just walk away, and the city will laugh the whole thing off. One councilman jokes,
it's heads the city wins. Tails, Hatfield loses.
Charlie and Paul set up camp in the remote hills surrounding the Morena Reservoir. This time, they work for weeks, building several towers. This is to be Charlie's biggest rain yet. When visitors come to observe his experiments, Charlie turns his back to them, hiding his notebooks and chemicals, and Paul fingers the trigger on his trusty rifle. And soon enough, it's pouring. Winds reach record speeds of over 60 miles per hour, but that isn't good enough. Charlie needs the legitimacy a satisfied San Diego can grant him, and so he works nonstop, dodging lightning bolts, relishing thunderclaps. He doesn't care that he's soaked to the bone. He can wield weather. The water downs power lines, floods streets, rips up rail tracks. A Mission Valley man, who had to be rescued by a rowboat as he clung to a scrap of lumber, wraps himself in a towel and shivers as he suggests,
let's pay Hatfield $100,000 to quit.
But Charlie isn't quitting. The rain comes down harder and harder. Dams and reservoirs across the county explode, and the flood devastates every farm, every house in its wake. One winemaker is surfacing from the protection of his cellar when he spies a wave twice the height of a telephone pole tearing down his street. He grabs his wife, and they run as fast as they can, only to turn and watch their house wash downstream. And yet, Charlie smiles as he surveys his success. The Morena Reservoir is full. He grabs Paul, and the two leave their camp to march the 50-odd miles to City Hall. He expects the indebted populace to kiss his mud-covered shoes. Instead, he's met with glares and threats. By the time Charlie and Paul reach San Diego's city center, they've stopped answering to the name Hatfield. They call themselves Benson to avoid bodily harm. Still, when he stands before the city councilman, Charlie declares his operations successful and demands his payment. The men glower at him. San Diego is in ruins, and worst of all, they've got blood on their hands. The flood drowned more than 50 people. It also destroyed homes, farms, telephone lines, railroads, streets, highways, and bridges. San Diegans file millions of dollars in claims. But Charlie doesn't budge. He folds his arms across his chest, holds his head high, and proclaims, "The time is coming when drought will overtake this portion of the state. It will be then that you call for my services again." So, the city councilmen tell Charlie that if he's sure he made it rain, they'll give him his $10,000. He'll just have to take full responsibility for the flood. Charlie grits his teeth and tells them it was coincidence. It rained because Mother Nature made it so. I am no rainmaker. Then Charlie disappears. He goes on selling sewing machines and keeping quiet.
I'll tell you what, California these days could use little Charlie Hatfield. Big thanks to Eliza Smith for sharing that story, and thanks as well to Leon Morimoto for sound design. Mischief Managed. You've just gotten to the other side by means of other ways. And if you missed any part of the show, no need for a rampage. Head on over to snapjudgment.org. There you'll find the award-winning podcast, Mark. What award do we win? Movies, pictures, stuff, amazing stories await. Get in on the conversation. Snap Judgment's on Facebook, Twitter, Snap Judgment. Now, Snap was produced by a team of warlocks so dreadful that the Ministry of Magic had to deny their very existence. He's got a lightning bolt tattoo on his forehead. At least he will soon. Give it up for the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. He's not the redheaded sidekick, Pat Mesiti Miller. She is an insufferable know-it-all, Ms. Harmony Sussman. Joe Rosenberg stars as Neville Longbottom. Nancy Hagrid Lopez, Davey Dobby Kim, Julia the Sorting Hat DeWitt, Renzo Malfoy Gorio. The Dementors, Eliza Smith, Anna Adlerstein, Aurora Soria, and Leon Morimoto. She who must not be named, I'm going to say it anyway, Jasmine Aguilera. Did you ever wind up in the Slytherin sitting room when you're supposed to be in Gryffindor's parlor? Well, me neither. But I'm sure it's nothing like wandering the halls of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Completely different, but many thanks to them. And you may have reckoned that this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could have just thrown that book with Voldemort trapped in it, thrown it in the fire, been done with the nonsense and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.